From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. COVID-19 has now killed more than 2,000 people and infected more than 75,000, most of those cases in mainland China. In Hong Kong, there has now been a second death from the virus, and Hong Kong has sent two planes to Japan to evacuate about 300 residents who have been quarantined on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship. They'll have another 2 weeks of quarantine once they get back to Hong Kong, where most of the quarantine beds are already full. NPR's global health and development correspondent Jason Beaubien is in Hong Kong and joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you. So where's the government going to put all of these people who are coming back from that cruise ship?
You know, that's been a very controversial question here. But the chief executive of the city, Carrie Lam, yesterday she said she's sending them to this public housing complex that was under construction. Most of it's finished, but no new residents had moved in yet. And she said they're not going to allow local opposition to scuttle this. There is no plan B, she said, and this is where they're going to quarantine these Diamond Cruise ship passengers.
Oh, wow. Why has it been so difficult to find spaces to quarantine these folks?
Well, you know, so Hong Kong is basically a city. We don't have, like, they don't have the Air Force bases that the U.S. is using. You know, there's definitely a NIMBY aspect, this not in my backyard opposition. A lot of people here, they're scared of this disease, and they don't want anyone moving in who might pose some sort of risk. A couple of weeks ago, the city had announced another similar plan at a public housing tower, and protesters set fire to the building. And secondly, Hong Kong already has thousands of people currently in quarantine. So finding space for more was really an issue. As of yesterday, there was 11,817 people under quarantine orders here.
Okay, so there are these quarantine facilities, and that actually means there probably are medical professionals there to monitor them. But there are also these thousands of people who are quarantined at home. Give us a sense of what restrictions they face and how is that actually being enforced if someone is choosing to just stay in their homes?
Right. And the vast majority of these people are under home quarantine orders, and they're not allowed to leave their homes. They're not allowed to go outside. They're supposed to be wearing face masks constantly and taking their temperature twice a day. Health officials are allowed to come and do spot checks on these people. But with nearly 12,000 individuals right now, I mean, that's nearly impossible. So yeah. Hong Kong is actually monitoring them by their phones. They're tracking their cell phones, sort of like find my location. And the people who are considered at high risk, those people from Hubei or people who've like violated earlier quarantine orders, they're actually getting fitted with a wrist tracker, sort of like an ankle bracelet. But mostly, this is an honor system. You know, you could always just leave your phone at home and go out and wander around if you wanted to. And that can be problematic. There was this old elderly guy. He actually had dementia, and he lives in Shenzhen, which is just across the border from Hong Kong in mainland China. And he just hopped on a bus and tried to head home. And the police got called out, and they came in full protective suits and face masks and sort of bundled him back in. You know, just managing all of these people who are under quarantine and people who are coming off of quarantine, it's been this huge administrative task for Hong Kong.
You know, that story about this older gentleman actually brings up this other point. The territory has not completely closed off access to mainland China since this outbreak. We're hearing Hong Kong's executive Carrie Lam has been harshly criticized by some for not actually doing that. Tell us what the situation is for that at the moment, how much traffic there is back and forth to mainland China right now.
So this 14-day quarantine rule has actually done more to close the border than anything else. Most people don't want to be subject to 2 weeks stuck at home. So traffic has pretty much come to a standstill between Hong Kong and mainland China.
Are there any signs that life is beginning to return to normal? We know that there are schools and offices and businesses that have been closed during all of this.
Yeah. You know, a lot of businesses have restarted. People are out on the streets, although everybody, or just about everybody, is wearing a mask. You know, I went to one hospital and the receptionist was standing on the other side of a glass door and it was locked, and she insisted that I phone her, and we stood there talking on our cell phones to each other through the glass door between us. So, you know, there's still things like that that are quite odd. The school issue really is the biggest thing at the moment about getting life back to normal, and not just for the kids, but for, you know, parents as well. Schools were supposed to restart this week, and now they're getting pushed back for at least another month. So I think once that happens, things will start to feel like they're getting more back to normal.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien in Hong Kong. Jason, as always, thank you.
It's good to talk to you, Tanya.
Well, Rod Blagojevich is out of prison more than 4 years early, thanks to a commutation from President Trump. The former Democratic governor of Illinois was serving 14 years for felonies, including wire fraud and conspiracy to solicit and accept bribes. Blagojevich spoke to reporters outside his home in Chicago earlier today.
This is an act of kindness, and I also believe it's the beginning of the process to actually turn an injustice into a justice.
Joining me now from Chicago is Dave McKinney, state politics reporter for WBEZ and host of the podcast Public Official A, which is all about Blagojevich. Dave, were you surprised by this commutation?
Well, I think we were all sort of prepped that there was going to be something sometime, but I think it caught everybody in Chicago, certainly in our newsroom, it caught everybody off guard. It like really happened.
And there are a lot of people that are very unhappy with this decision on both sides of the political aisle. All five of the Republicans currently representing Illinois districts in the U.S. House of Representatives issued a joint statement yesterday calling Blagojevich the face of public corruption in Illinois. They wrote, as our state continues to grapple with political corruption, we shouldn't let those who breach the public trust off the hook. Democrats are criticizing this decision to commute his sentence as well. What's been the reaction like in Illinois?
Well, it's just exactly as you describe. I mean, we've got a really active public corruption investigation underway now that implicates a lot of people in the state house and a lot of lobbying interests. And the Republicans had hoped to use some of that to their advantage. But this decision by the president kind of undercuts that. And you could hear the frustration from the House Republican leader in Springfield, for example, said, I hope Donald Trump now realizes that there's no chance he's going to win Illinois in the fall. So, I mean, there's a lot of bitterness. The congressional delegation you mentioned, the Republicans, had all come together prior to this and said, do not do this, President Trump. Hmm. And he did it anyway. So there's a high level of frustration.
Although, interestingly, we reached out to all of them today and none of them have said yes to our interview request. So they want to issue their statement, but maybe not go on the record in an interview and criticize the president's decision, at least not yet. Blagojevich is out of prison more than 4 years early. He was given a 14-year sentence back in 2011. You've been following him all along. Remind us what he did and why he was in jail.
Well, I mean, a lot of people remember when Barack Obama won his first term as president, that opened up a Senate seat in Illinois. And so the governor here had the ability to fill that. And he put a great deal of emphasis on that and thought that there was some way that he could leverage that either to political advantage or to personal advantage. And what ultimately led to his convictions were that, you know, the government caught him on tape trying to extort the executive of a children's hospital in Chicago and a racetrack owner and trying to leverage a union for a high paying job and of course the Obama seat. So I mean all of those things, the extortion, the corruption, it was all caught on tape, you know, in rather shocking detail.
President Trump and Blagojevich have a history together. Here's the president speaking yesterday to reporters.
I don't know him very well. I met him a couple of times. He was on for a short while of The Apprentice years ago. Seemed like a very nice person. Don't know him.
Says he doesn't know him, but mentions that he was on Trump's TV show, The Apprentice. What is Blagojevich's relationship with Trump?
Well, I mean, if you know, to anyone who's watched that show, they might remember that it was Trump who fired Blagojevich from that program. So, I mean, they did go back. Back in 2010, Donald Trump did an interview with Howard Stern about Rod Blagojevich. And even back then, Trump was expressing, dissatisfaction that Blagojevich was in trouble. I mean, he called him a fighter at that point. And that's really kind of continued. And it really, really started picking up once Trump began as president. And in 2018, aboard Air Force One in late May, I mean, he really kind of went on a rampage about how unfair Blagojevich had been treated. And of course, the common threads were that many of the people that were involved in the Russia probe of Trump were also involved in the prosecution of Blagojevich. Hmm. And so that's where Trump has gone with this.
You know, it was pointed out on Twitter that it has been many, many years now since there was not an Illinois governor in prison. You could also look at that and say, in Illinois, used to be, no one was above the law.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really at the heart of this 14-year sentence that was handed down by former Judge James Zagel here in Chicago. I mean, I think, you know, we were coming out of an era where Blagojevich's predecessor, George Ryan, a Republican, had had his own fundraising scandal that resulted in federal prison term for him. Zagel was trying to send a message here, a deterrent that public corruption has consequences. And I think, you know, in a state like Illinois, where we have corruption probes all over the place that are going on now, the message that this sends, I think, is causing a lot of people in the law enforcement community to really kind of wonder what in the world is the president thinking here? You know, basically giving an ex-governor who was really caught on tape talking about a lot of bad things, giving him a get-out-of-jail-free card. Does that send the right message? A lot of people here don't think it sends the right message.
That is Dave McKinney, who is a state politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago and host of the podcast Public Official A, which is all about Rod Blagojevich. Dave, thank you.
Thanks much.
And listeners in Illinois, let us know what you think about Governor Blagojevich's commutation at hereandnow.org. Michael Bloomberg will be on the 2020 debate stage for the first time in Nevada tonight, and President Trump's pardon power is under scrutiny after he granted clemency to 11 people yesterday, most of them politically connected people, such as former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Let's bring in our political strategist, Yvette Simpson, a Democratic strategist, and Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
And let's start with that debate. Michael Bloomberg will be there, joining Biden, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Sanders, and Warren. They say he has bought his way in, but he is now leading in some polls in some states. Yvette, let's start with you. What are you going to be watching for tonight?
The big thing is how he responds to attacks on his record. So for the first couple months, I think when he was starting to put these ads out, they were really unchecked. And in the last month, you've seen a lot of folks start to question by video, you know, some of his policies, particularly on stop and frisk, his history with women. He's got quite a checkered past from his time in the mayor's office. And so the question is, will the moderators challenge him and ask him to answer those questions? Will folks like Warren and Sanders, who really are opposed to him on a lot of these policies, really challenge him? Because this is the one opportunity, actually the first opportunity to really get the chance to have him on the hot seat and on the defense about his challenging record.
Matt, what do you think? What are you going to be watching for tonight?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, I think Bloomberg's going to be on defense tonight. Whether he's able to substantively answer these attacks, whether he's able to explain how he's changed his view on major issues, including as recently as last year. These are not minor problems that he's dealing with on stop and frisk, on comments he's made about different groups of Americans that are part of the Democratic constituency, on having been a Republican, on having endorsed against Obama. I mean, you can go down the list. He's made critical comments about Obamacare. So, for a long time, it seemed like the Democrats have been, you know, generally aligned on most issues, with perhaps a couple that are pushing Medicare for All and things that are a little more progressive. Bloomberg's history and, I guess, his present are really at odds, and that's what's going to be, I think, so significant tonight. The question is whether his momentum is going to be arrested, right? He has been rising in the polls entirely on his financial backing for his, you know,
his ads
that have just net, you know, that are infinite, quite literally infinite. I think he's already spent $400 million across the country. So we've never seen this kind of capital infusion by one candidate for the presidency. But he's a new Democrat. He's a new entrant into this field and a new Democrat. And I think tonight he's going to be on defense quite a bit.
But what about Bernie Sanders, who, you know, came in either first or second, depending how you count it, in Iowa, and then came in first in New Hampshire? He's leading nationally and in Nevada. Last night at a CNN town hall with Anderson Cooper, Sanders says he has no plans to release further medical records, which might give some details about his heart attack that he had last year. Let's listen.
And by the way, you think I'm not in good health, come on out with me on the campaign trail, and I'll let you introduce me to the three or four rallies a day that we do. How's that?
But just to be clear, you don't plan to release any more records?
I don't. I don't think we will, no.
Okay, so Yvette, is he going to be able to get away with that, with these candidates, aside from Sanders, wanting to take some of his support away?
You know, we'll see. I see this as a red herring. You've got four candidates over the age of 70. Is the contest who's the most healthy and who's going to last the longest? I mean, I think he gave three letters. I think that's the most we've seen from many people. He's given his tax returns. And so I think what he said is, I've given more than most, you know, put up or shut up. Don't ask me if you're not willing to give. And so, one of the things that I think is kind of problematic, particularly with a field like this, is we're really saying, is this ageist? You know, we're saying he's over 70. And he's right. I mean, compared to Donald Trump, who probably has, you know, how many McDonald's burgers a day, definitely not a healthy president. Elizabeth Warren is running circles around folks. Joe Biden looks really, really tired. You know, I wonder if this is the best way to use our energy. And I think Bernie Sanders is going to probably call that out and say, you know what, we're all of a certain age, particularly the top front runners. This is ageist. I've given as much as I'm going to give. Now the rest of you put up or shut up.
Matt, we were talking today with Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and he said that in Virginia, where there's an open primary and even Republicans can go and vote in the Democratic primary, that he expects many Republicans will go and vote for Sanders because they think he's going to be the easiest for Trump to beat. Have you heard? Is that something that's going on in Republican circles around the country?
So it's not as kind of specific and it not as promoted as the Operation Chaos idea was promoted by Rush Limbaugh, I think, in 2008. But it is out there. And of course, Trump, when he was in New Hampshire the night before the New Hampshire primary, suggested that maybe some of his supporters would cross in that open primary. You might see that in Nevada as well on Saturday with the caucuses. There are other states that have open primaries. I think that's probably along the margins. There's actually a lot of overlap in support between Trump and Bernie in terms of populist views, and so that connection is closer than you might first think it would be. So I think that could be a factor. I don't think it'll be a significant factor.
Let's talk about some of the other candidates who will be on the stage tonight. Joe Biden, who is trying to prove that he's got support of minority voters, including Latinos in Nevada. He was asked by Univision's Jorge Ramos whether he would apologize for the 3 million undocumented immigrants who were deported by the Obama administration. Here he is.
It was a mistake. It was a mistake, and it took too long to get it right. It took too long to get it right.
So he's apologizing there. And then on CNN last night, Pete Buttigieg was asked about Rush Limbaugh's comments, wondering if America is ready to elect a gay president, and Trump apparently telling Limbaugh, according to Limbaugh, not to apologize for that. Listen.
The idea of the likes of Rush Limbaugh or Donald Trump lecturing anybody on family values? I mean, I'm sorry, but one thing about my marriage is it's never involved me having to send hush money to a porn star after cheating on my spouse.
Yvette, as you hear those two candidates, and of course, then there'll also be Elizabeth Warren on the stage tonight and Amy Klobuchar. What do those candidates need to do?
You know, I think this is do or die for all four of them for obvious reasons. You know, Joe Biden has staked his claim on black and brown voters. He did horribly last place in New Hampshire, second to last in Iowa. And he's saying black and brown voters are with me. So he has to be right here and he has to show some strength here. He also is going to be on the defense there, right? Because his record with the crime bill and some other kind of historical things that he's already kind of battled before. Amy Klobuchar needs to show that lightning can strike twice, right? She hasn't acknowledged and, of course, knows that she doesn't have the type of support in Nevada and in South Carolina, but thinks that she can build it one election at a time. But the question is, will she have another breakthrough performance enough to get her through Nevada? Pete Buttigieg, who recently took some fire for falsifying support in the black community, saying that he has support where he doesn't. He has to defend that, his record with African-Americans and brown people, pretty desperate. And I think Elizabeth Warren is fighting from this erasure syndrome, right? People have pretty much counted her out after New Hampshire. She says she has support in Nevada and South Carolina. And I think she has to show up in this debate and not disappear, meaning she has to be active the entire time and show that she's still in this race.
Matt, do you agree with that? Do you think it's do or die for all the other four other than Bloomberg and Sanders tonight?
Yeah, I do. I think it is. You're going to see signs of desperation, I think, among those candidates. And Yvette's right. I mean, Warren sort of disappeared from the last debate, and that's not necessarily her fault. But you have to interject. You have to raise your hand. At some point, you have to interrupt so that you don't get lost. I think this debate could come down to Biden Bernie and Bloomberg, the three Bs, the killer bees, I guess you could call them. And everyone else could kind of get left out if they're not careful. But they're all desperate, you know, for different reasons. She rightly identifies that Amy and Pete have had really almost no minority support. That's a huge test in Nevada. Of course, Amy hasn't really had to scale her campaign, hasn't had the resources to do that until very recently. I think she's raised $10 million since New Hampshire, put her first television ad up in Nevada the day after the New Hampshire primary. And look, this is about Super Tuesday as well, right? If you don't finish in the top two in Nevada or the top two in South Carolina, you're going to have no money for Super Tuesday. You're going to be nowhere when Texas and California and all these other states are voting, when 40% of the delegates are allocated on March 3rd. So this race is going to winnow whether these candidates recognize it, whether they drop out or not in the next few weeks. It's going to get down to two or three people who have a legitimate mathematical path to, if not the nomination, then to a plurality going into the convention in Milwaukee.
Okay, finally, let me just switch gears for a second here. The sentencing of Roger Stone takes place tomorrow on charges stemming from the Russia investigation. And today there are multiple reports that Attorney General William Barr has told people close to the president that he's considering resigning if Trump doesn't stop commenting on ongoing legal matters. Yvette, do you believe that Barr is considering resigning?
I am waiting for him to say that he's resigning. I'm in a put up or shut up moment with Bill Barr. I mean, how many lawyers from the DOJ, former lawyers, have to ask him to resign? I think it's posturing. I don't know if, you know, if he hasn't done it yet, I don't know what it's going to take. I like the fact that he's at least acknowledging that the pressure from the president is getting to him. But the question is, will he do it? And if so, he needs to do it right now.
And Matt, do you think that Roger Stone is going to get a pardon the way that Rod Blagojevich did yesterday? He got a commutation?
I think the odds that Roger ultimately gets pardoned are probably better than 50%, but I think the odds that it happens before the election are pretty low. I think it'd be an unfortunate distraction on the strong economy, the other things the president's done. He has the wind at his back right now, I think, politically. He has over the last couple of weeks. His numbers are rising.
Do you think it was the right move for him to pardon or to commute Blagojevich's sentence?
I don't personally, but it was a commutation. He'd served, you know, a certain period of time, and they get 4 years left. But no, I don't. And the fact that the Illinois delegation has opposed that, I think, would have been a really good example of that. But look, pardon power is pretty much unlimited. The president can use it however he wants. I think I saw an analysis yesterday. He's only done 76 of these. Carter did over 500 in 4 years. Mm. So something to keep in mind.
So another few hundred left to come, maybe. We'll see. Matt Mikowiak, a Republican strategist, and Yvette Simpson, Democratic strategist. Thanks so much to both of you. We'll be watching tonight.
Thank y'all.
Thank you.
As the Democrats prepare to debate tonight in Nevada, another debate is brewing over whether it's okay to recline your airplane seat. A woman tweeted out a video of herself on an American Airlines flight. The man sitting behind her was repeatedly hitting the back of her seat after she reclined her chair. And now the woman, Wendy Williams, is speaking out. Here she is on Fox Business Channel.
I think that guy, the guy definitely needs to be prosecuted. And I feel like it's kind of a David and Goliath story with American Airlines because they're this big company and I'm just a teacher, you know, and they should, for them to put that statement out there, that their concern is their comfort of their customers, it's just rubbish.
She's referring to an American Airlines statement that said the safety and comfort of our customers and team members are our top priorities, and our team is looking into the issue. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now with more on this. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this has sparked a really big debate online about who was right. Let's go through each side. What is the argument against allowing passengers to recline their seat?
Well, it's simply that there's less leg room than there used to be. That person behind you is closer to you than they would have been on most airlines several years ago. And that's something I've thought about in recent years as I've kind of become a little bit more careful about reclining than I used to be.
What about the argument in favor? Because I would think if the seat can do it and you're crammed into a small place, why shouldn't you be able to lean back?
Absolutely. You know, most airlines still allow you to recline. There are airlines that have fixed the seats so that you can't do it. But if you're allowed by the airline to do it, then you have the right to recline, right? Another inalienable right that surely would have been in the Constitution had they had airplanes back then, right? And I typically have, like I said, I've thought about this more over the years, but I've typically felt that way. I don't mind if the person in front of me reclines into me gently, respectfully, and I'll do the same thing to the person behind me. Now, the man in that video was in the last row. His seat didn't recline, and people online have said, well, if you're sitting in the second to the last row, maybe you really shouldn't recline. But I'm not sure how well that logic works, because then what's the person in the third to the last row supposed to think about the person in the second
slope.
To the last row? I mean, at some point, you're going to have somebody reclining into somebody who's not able to recline.
So Delta's CEO, and this was an American Airlines flight that this happened on, but Delta's CEO weighed in on this, saying in a recent interview that you should ask before reclining. And people were upset because they say, wait a minute, you're the airline that's making these seats so small with no legroom.
And I thought that was interesting that Delta's CEO actually came out and said something more substantive, whatever you think about it, than Americans said. They sort of just said they're looking into this. But yeah, no, it's true. It's not just our imagination. Seats on a lot of airlines are getting closer together. And a few of the ultra-low-cost carriers, as they call themselves, led first by Spirit, said, okay, enough with the reclining. Spirit said, we pre-recline your seats. That sounded like a funny euphemism at the time, but they said, basically they were fixing the seats at a slight recline. You couldn't move them. They weren't trying to avoid fights. I mean, they were trying to save money because reclining seats have extra parts and way more and all that and saving money. But a benefit of that is that nobody on Spirit fights over anybody reclining their seat into them anymore.
I have to say, from my last experience on Spirit, the words comfort and reclined didn't really fit into how I thought about my seat. But maybe I was just on the wrong plane. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
As the Democratic candidates gear up for tonight's debate, we're looking at where they stand on foreign policy. Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start with Iran. So Democratic candidates have criticized the Trump administration's decision to kill the Iranian general Qassem Soleimani. But Senator Bernie Sanders was asked on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert last month how he would respond to some of Iran's provocations. And he called for getting Iran and Saudi Arabia to settle their differences.
I think what we do is use our diplomatic power and our resources to demand that these people, whether they like it or not, are going to sit in a room and they're going to start working out the differences they have. Because I think the American people are tired of getting sucked into wars that are a result of their differences.
Nahal, I'm curious from you, what are some of the other candidates saying about how they would handle the relationship with Iran?
Well, pretty much everybody among the Democrats is big on pursuing diplomacy with Iran and other actors. They feel like under the Trump administration, it's been too much about sanctions, too much about military force. And so they say, look, we'll use every form of diplomacy we can think of, including turning to other partners, bringing in, of course, the Europeans, even the Russians, the Chinese, and trying to use this lever more than the Trump administration has. Mm-hmm. Another thing that the Democrats generally say is that they want to rejoin the nuclear deal with Iran,
yes,
the one that Trump left. And so that's a big part of what they would say is their diplomatic push. The problem is that, look, putting Saudi Arabia and Iran together in a room to work out their differences, and it sounds really nice on paper, but I mean, if this was something that would have worked, you would have think people would have done it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And going back to the nuclear deal is simply not going to be that easy, given that there are a number of deadlines and aspects of the nuclear deal that are going to be close to expiring. And Iran is going to want not only sanctions relief from the United States, but possibly even compensation for the last 2 years of the U.S. not being in the nuclear deal and Iran having been punished by sanctions that Trump has put back on. So this is like, it's super complicated and it's really nice. You know, the Democrats are saying things now like, oh, diplomacy and partners and, we're just going to rejoin the nuclear deal. But reality is just much more complicated.
There was also news this week about a deal that could end America's longest war, the war in Afghanistan. Pete Buttigieg is the only candidate who served in that war. He told CBS News in September that the U.S. should wind things down there. And I want to note that we're about to play some sound, but it has a little bit of noise in it because it was during an outdoor interview in September. Let's listen.
We need to wrap this up quickly, and we do need to move to where there is only the minimum required residual force to protect American lives. But we need to make sure this is done in a way that makes sense. That means making sure the Afghan government is at the table, not only the Taliban, and it means making sure we get some assurances on counterterrorism so that we're not back there again in a few years.
We have yet to see how this latest agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban will play out. But what are some of the other ways Democrats are saying they would take this on in really addressing the complexity of this kind of exit?
Well, I mean, there are some who are basically taking like the very progressive position of we have to get out, period. We have to end the endless war in Afghanistan. Buttigieg is actually one of the more moderate ones. Like, he's openly admitting that he wants to leave some U.S. troops there to deal with things like counterterrorism and that type of thing, and to help make sure that the Afghan government doesn't collapse the minute that the U.S. leaves. The others are not quite as forward in admitting that. But I think, again, once they're in office, they're going to look at the situation and they're going to say, okay, well, maybe we do need to leave a few thousand U.S. troops there, but we're definitely not going to call them combat troops. They're going to be advisors or trainers or counterterrorism, I don't know, people who help assistants, anything but combat troops, because that's really kind of the definition that it comes down to. Recently, Elizabeth Warren, like, you know, made this thing where she said on a debate stage, like, I want to get out of the Middle East. And then later on, she had to clarify, oh, I just meant I want to pull our combat troops out of the Middle East.
Vice President Joe Biden has taken some heat for his vote in 2002 to authorize the Iraq War. What do you make of how Biden is grappling with the Iraq War?
His lack of clarity on this issue, I think, is definitely going to be a challenge for him. And you can understand why his, especially the progressive candidates who are trying to defeat him in the primary, would use it as a cudgel against him.
I mean, Sanders has also been criticized for voting to authorize the war in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that's part of the issue, right? I mean, it's trying to make the distinction between, you know, the good war and the stupid war, right? And so, like, you've got the Democrats who say, look, I was fine with going into Afghanistan. That was a noble war. We had to find justice for September 11th. But Iraq was a war of choice, and so it was a stupid war, and so we shouldn't have gone in there.
I want to talk to you about North Korea. So last year around this time, President Trump met with Kim Jong-un in Hanoi. But an agreement was not reached on getting North Korea to dismantle its nuclear arsenal. What are Democrats saying about how they'd handle North Korea?
Well, they have different approaches. Like Elizabeth Warren and others have, you know, said they might be willing to meet with Kim if there's a process involved that leads up to it. Like, they wouldn't just give out a meeting without any conditions. Others, like Joe Biden, have said that, no, they're not going to meet with Kim. And they think that that was a huge mistake on the part of President Trump to have met with Kim Jong-un three times. But I don't see any of them saying anything creative about how they're going to convince Kim Jong-un to give up his arsenal. The thing that, frankly, nobody is willing to really say, because, you mean, it would be like probably like political suicide to say it, is simply, guess what, guys? North Korea is a nuclear power, and it's not going to give up its nuclear weapons, and we're going to have to learn how to deal with it. And that's not something any of them are willing to say, including, I should add, President Trump.
I want to ask you about former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Many people have probably seen his ads criticizing Donald Trump, but a lot of his positions are not well known. What do we know about where he stands on foreign policy?
Well, we know that he thinks about issues like climate change and trade in the broader context of foreign policy, right? So he also is not averse to the idea of having to deal with authoritarian regimes. He may not necessarily prefer them, but he kind of accepts the reality that they're there. So on the issue, for instance, of China and how to deal with China, you know, he's going to take a typically, you know, hawkish stand about China in general. But he also is very realistic that the Chinese are people we're going to have to deal with on issues like climate change in particular. This is a major power, and they are someone that you can't avoid. So for him, I think it's going to have to be a very like pragmatist, practical type of approach if he becomes president.
Aside from specific proposals, some Democrats are also offering kind of this larger vision to counter President Trump on foreign policy. Here's Senator Amy Klobuchar at the Council on Foreign Relations back in December, describing her plan on foreign policy, which she calls the five R's.
Restoring American leadership, repairing our alliances, rejoining international agreements, responding appropriately to the challenges that come before us, and reasserting American values.
What do you think Democrats are actually putting forward? What's the big message to Americans when it comes to foreign policy?
I would say the big message is we are not alone, and we have to turn to our friends and rely on our friends. This whole idea of, alliances is, I think, probably the one key message that they all want to get across is we're not going to spurn people in Europe. We're not going to ignore our allies in South Korea and Japan. We need them, and we really can't do this without them. And the trick for them is going to be, how are they going to manage to do that without being accused by Republicans of, say, going on an apology tour, right? So that's where it's challenging. But Trump has made it very clear that he does not see alliances the same way as past presidents have, Republican or Democrat. And I think that that's very much a key area that Democrats are going to exploit, is simply saying America is going to be the leader, but we're not going to be doing this alone.
Nahal Tusi is foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The mountains of West Texas are unlike any other part of that state, and so are the animals you find there, including desert bighorn sheep. If you're lucky enough to see one, you'll know it. Their massive, curly-cue horns make them unmistakable. Desert bighorn sheep nearly disappeared from the state in the 1960s, but now there are about 1,500 bighorns in Texas thanks to a relocation program. As Texas Standards' Michael Marks reports, maintaining the population requires a hands-on approach.
It's a clear, cool morning in West Texas, and about 50 people are watching a helicopter wind its way around the south side of Elephant Mountain, a brown, flat-topped summit about 250 miles southeast of El Paso. The sun isn't all the way up yet, but it's clear the helicopter is hauling some unusual cargo.
Looks like we got some sheep coming in. Yeah, we got some slung there.
That's Bob Dittmar, state wildlife veterinarian for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And he's right. Dangling about 15 feet below the helicopter are two desert bighorn sheep. They have already had quite a day. Caught in a net, then blindfolded, hobbled, tied to the helicopter, then flown to the base of the mountain, where the pilot gingerly lowers the sheep to the ground. Now, the reason sheep are being choppered off Elephant Mountain at all is simple. There's too many of them up there. Again, here's veterinarian Bob Dittmar.
Elephant's been a very successful breed sat and probably combines good habitat, good management, and just probably a little bit of luck.
Thing is, there's not enough space or food to support the 180 or so bighorns that live there. So Texas Parks and Wildlife has been relocating some of them. It's a huge operation, but it's also critical to the species' long-term survival. The plan is to catch 74 sheep, gather as much data about them as possible, and then release them at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, 50 miles to the southeast.
So it's helping the population here at Elephant by alleviating that browsing pressure and helping that or augment that restoration at Black Gap.
That's Froilan Hernandez, the Desert Bighorn Sheep Program Leader for Texas Parks and Wildlife. For as strong as individual bighorns appear, their population is fragile. They're native to West Texas. You can find ancient petroglyphs of them. But as recently as the 1960s, there were no bighorns here whatsoever. Zero. Diseases from domestic sheep and overhunting pushed them out when ranchers came in the late 1800s. Ever since they died out in Texas, the state's been trying to bring them back. But it's taken 80 years to restore their population to what it was before ranchers moved in. There's still a long way to go.
Our goal is to repopulate all 17, 18 mountain ranges that are of historic habitat with about 3,000 animals.
Which is why this relocation is so important. Spreading bighorns throughout West Texas gives individual herds more room to grow and insulates them from diseases like pneumonia, which has decimated bighorns in other states. Back at Elephant Mountain, once the helicopter clears off, the bighorns are carried 20 yards to a makeshift biology lab, where 50 veterinarians, volunteers, and biologists get busy. Walt Cook is a veterinarian with Texas A&M University.
When we do a capture event like this, and when Parks and Wildlife does a capture event like this, we try to take advantage of that and get every conceivable sample we think that we need or that we might need in the future.
The process starts with taking each bighorn's temperature and a blood sample.
And then go in quick.
Okay.
Go in quick.
They're surprisingly compliant as veterinarians tilt their heads back to slide a long syringe into their jugular.
105.2, 105.3.
While this is happening, other volunteers collect hair samples and attach a numbered yellow tag to each of the sheep's ears. Then, after getting a tonsil swab and a radio collar around their neck, the sheep is ready to be loaded into a trailer, which can be tricky.
Woo! Didn't get kicked.
Over 3 days, 74 bighorns go through this process and are then trucked 2.5 hours away to their new home. It's pitch black outside when we arrive at the release site at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. There are 4 trailers, and it takes a few minutes to maneuver each one so its door faces a rocky hill 30 yards away. Once they're in place, biologist Travis Smith unlatches the first door,
y'all ready?
Opens it up, and then nothing. The first sheep just stands there. It takes a little bit of this, but then finally, the first sheep hops out of the trailer, bounds down the road, and fades into the brush. One by one, or two by two, the rest follow.
That's really cool to see them like that. I mean, I get goosebumps every time I get that. It's awesome to see them that way.
It's the first time all day we've seen these animals move out in the open. They're fast, sure-footed, speeding up as they hit the rocky slope ahead of them. They look right at home out here. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Marks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.